Hello, everyone, and welcome to Dominaria's Judgment, number 88. I am Ari Lax, here with not quite your usual host. Dom is out and about at the Canadian Regional Championships this weekend, along with some other interesting events that have impacted our schedule this week. So we have Jarvis Yu back again to discuss four-color control in Modern, a deck that has, you know, had previous success since the Yorian ban has kind of quieted down, but it started to have another wave of success, and it's probably worth talking about since I bet a lot of people are excited to pick back up their Ren and Sixes and Teferis.
Yo, what's up, everyone?
And I promise this time that the math will probably stop at four. Maybe we'll talk about the fifth color at some point, but there will be a significantly lower amount of math than last time. What there will not be a lower amount of is intro and typical housekeeping stuff, so as always, you can find the podcast wherever good podcasts are distributed. You are listening to it now. You have probably found it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, you know, all the usual spots. You can find us on Twitter. I am at ARMLX. Dom is at Dom and Harvia. The pod is at Dominaria underscore pod. You can find us on Discord. There's a handy link on the Twitter to that, as well as in the show notes for this week. And you can find us on Patreon, where, again, we'd like to thank our new patron, Rachel. But your support is really useful in, you know, helping us, you know, pay for things like Mana Traders and come back every week with really good results. I mean, at least me, I don't know. I use Mana Traders. I know Jarvis has dabbled, but the rental services are pretty good these days for Magic Online, if you're into Boomer clients.
Yeah, definitely agree. I think it's never been easier, really, to play Magic the Gathering online at a low budget if you really want to. Even I think the delta between playing paper vintage and online vintage is, it's kind of insane to think about, because I think it's way easier to play you know, MTGO vintage than paper vintage, which is, you know, probably some fraction of your house or whatever, you know.
Yeah, it's vintage cards are a lot. And with that segue, as opposed to the segue talking about the arena economy, since you, the Legacy expert, are on today, let's talk about the things that happened in Legacy this week, which was the banning of, well, you know, the best white card in the format and the, like, seventh best blue card in a specific deck.
Yeah, kind of interesting. I actually, at Pro Tour Philadelphia, one thing I like to do is talk to the Wizards of the Coast employees. And in particular, one of our former teammates, Benjamin Weitz, I had a conversation with him, as well as some of the Philadelphia natives who play Legacy. You know, the Mid-Atlantic is a pretty strong Legacy scene, so there were some people there. So we had a chat with him. I like to think that it helped somewhat, but also apparently they had, you know, their internal data saying that, you know, is it Delver and Mono White Initiative are the best decks? And they sort of keep it each other in check. So if you ban something from one deck, you kind of have to ban something from the other deck, I think was their logic.
Yeah, so in this case, it was White Plume Adventurer, which in the case of the initiative deck is like a pretty obvious hit. It's just like there are 8 million cards that cost 4 with initiative, and there's one that costs 3. So if you just ban the one that costs 3, that's a good start. And then Expressive Iteration out of Izzet, I think that you might be able to speak a little bit better to the contextual stuff there. There's sort of probably a rule that you just aren't legally allowed to ban the actual card that's a problem, but I think that, like, Iteration is a totally fine card to ban, because it sort of, at least in Modern, like, one of the things is that Iteration is the most important way for Izzet to defeat the grindy decks. And in Legacy, we kind of have seen just, like, a huge drop-off. I know when I did commentary for Legacy Champs for Anu, there was the Bant Uro deck that just kind of disappeared. And it feels like that might be a deck that could have some more power in this currently updating metagame.
Yeah, to summarize it quickly, I think, not to spend too long in it, I think if you remove Expressive Iteration from Izzet, Delver, and Legacy, its ability to grind is severely hampered, because there's no, like, two-for-one effect. And also, Izzet was one of the best decks at abusing Expressive Iteration, because of its curve is so low. Sometimes you see Mishra's Bauble, and Mystic Sanctuary, the card that's been gone for Modern and forever, also very powerful with the card, in conjunction with Days to pick up the Sanctuary. So there's a lot going on there that makes Izzet Delver probably the best Expressive Iteration deck in Legacy, and it's easier to attack it with 1-for-1 removal and Uro now, as opposed to before, where I kind of thought that actually wasn't a great plan for a lot of those Bant Uro decks.
Yeah, now that Uro, like, cast both sides is actually putting you significantly head on cards, like, the Delver deck still has a million cantrips, but those just are exchanging cards for cards, and, like, you can probably assemble some raw quantity and deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason you saw the move away from Bant to 4-color in Legacy was to play their own iterations and Minxin Boo, as well as abusing the fact that Carpet of Flowers is kind of insane versus the Delver deck traditionally. So all those factors, I think, they were basically forced to play, you know, fight fire with fire instead of just not having to play a 4-color.
Do you think Minskin Boo is good enough to keep playing that, or would you kind of, you know...
My initial thought is I would rather be Bant. I know Anurag just loves to play 4-colors regardless if it's correct or not. In fact, the name of his deck is What Have I Done? And it's been that for like 3 years.
Got it. I got distracted by looking at Legacy lists and discovering the Mono Black Curses deck, but...
Mono Black Curses. There's like a few people who play it, and I know roughly what's in the deck, but the other like 7 cards in the deck, I can't tell you what they... I would fail the check of like Curse of Misfortunes or whatever. I think that's the one that actually tutors up other curses, but whatever. Yeah.
Anyways, back to real decks. I think we're just pending, you know, Initiative has still been floating around, and maybe Jarvis will have some opinions on that in the future. It's a little different when you can't play an Initiative creature that costs less than 4, but at the same time, that also opens up... there's a lot more playable 3-drops than 4-drops in Legacy, it feels like. So, like, whatever replaces White Plume in the Initiative shell feels like a bigger decision.
Yeah, I think what's going to happen is you don't die on, like, turn 5 as often, but maybe there's still something there. Honestly, I'm going to let the formerly Death and Tax experts that pioneered the Initiative deck figure out if Initiative is still good. If it's not, I'm sure they'll tell me. If it is, well, the more power to them, you know?
Yeah. And with that, let's talk about a format where you are actually allowed to play with 4-colors, and that is Modern. Jarvis, you have been playing 4-color control in Modern recently. I know we were both at the same RCQ this last weekend, and you were playing that deck. I was busy playing Scam, which is great, and we talked about last week, but 4-color is kind of like the exact reverse of my current wheelhouse in the format. So I guess I kind of want to start with, you know, what brought you back to 4-color after the Yorion ban?
So before Phyrexia All Will Be One came out, I actually did play a Modern RCQ with a deck that was, you could describe it as 4-color... mid-range 4-color control, however you want to slice it. It actually looked a lot like this deck. If you imagine replacing the Eldarmy's Call as Abundant Growths with 4 Expressive Iteration, playing 4 Fable with Mirror Breaker, and obviously not playing Elishorn, this is what I would describe as the Zoomer 4-color deck. They had been playing that for a while. I think Wing Tusar had a few showings with the deck on MTGO, and when I looked at the deck, I liked most of what was going on. They tended to play a lot of Chalice of the Voids in the main, which I didn't love. But generally, that's where I started. And then after Phyrexia All Will Be One came out, the thing that I noticed the most, and, you know, it's kind of weird, I think Elishnorn Mother of Machines is immune to a lot of the removal in the format, and it also is sort of a weird hammer versus a lot of decks. So that's why I wanted to come back to this deck. I don't think playing Expressive Iteration plus Elishnorn is actually great. I think if you want that card, you want it on demand, not just, you know, on like turn 15 after you've seen like a third of your deck or whatever.
Yeah, so I guess to just break down your current list, mana base is what, 24 lands? Pretty typical spread. Are you still on multiple Busagus right now?
There's two main and one sideboard. I think in my mind, if Hammer Time didn't exist, I wouldn't play that many Busagus. But obviously, it gives you coverage versus Blood Moon, which is nice. It gives you coverage versus opposing Fables. It gives you coverage versus opposing Leyline Bindings. Although, that Elishnorn is also a weird sort of, oh, I guess you can't binding any of my shit anyways sort of deal. So I mean, it's also an untapped green source. It's kind of hard for Bosager to be bad in this deck.
Yeah, also coverage versus Dom and his amulets. Pretty good there. So 24 lands, 11 fetches and a typical spread of fetchables and Bosagers. 4 Prismatic Ending, 4 Leyline Binding, 3 Eladamer's Call, 2 Abundant Growths, 4 Ren, 4 Teferi, 2 Fables, an Endurance, 4 Omnath, Elish, 3 Furies, 4 Solitudes. And then I guess we'll get to the sideboard a bit later. Have you made any updates to this, or are you still sticking with this fairly Fury-heavy list?
I'm not sure. Most of the reason I wanted to play this sort of shell was when I played Rakdos Scam, I also noticed Fury was very good. So if you're going to play 4-color and not play as many Furies, I don't think it makes a lot of sense. Because I think if you notice that Fury is good in Rakdos Scam versus a lot of decks, then it stands to reason that Fury should be good in 4-color versus a lot of decks as well.
Yeah, 4-color is a slightly better deck at casting Fury, which is one of the more powerful cards of the card. I guess to sort of rewind, you were talking about playing this deck before 1. Do you like have a good reason why it just stopped? Obviously, the Yorian Ban was a big deal, but was that the sole reason it just stopped existing in the format, or were there like other metagame considerations related to that?
I think there were a few metagame considerations for sure. I don't think this deck is actually great versus a lot of linear decks in game 1. It felt like for a while the format just sped up when 4C Yorian disappeared, which is kind of weird to say because I think a lot of the linear decks were actually sort of okay versus 4C Yorian in a weird sort of way. I'm not really sure how to explain it, except right now I think the format is grindier than it's ever been, instead of, you know, dying to like the Bob 49s of the world playing Charbelt or whatnot.
Yeah, I think that you might be able to tie a little bit of that to like a big drop off in Cascade around the same time, which means a big drop off in Force Negation. And so you just had a lot of room open for people to just, you know, try and mush you. So even if their deck was good against Yorian, it was like even better against like the post Yorian world with less interaction. And I guess fast forwarding to today, so you've talked a lot about Elish Norn. Would you like to just talk some more about what it specifically did to this deck?
So it does a lot of things. Some of them are small, some of them are big. One huge thing is I think it's actually sort of a weird sort of spellskite in a lot of ways, except a lot of the removal in the format can't even kill it. The reason I say this is it disables Leyline Binding, it disables Fury, it disables Solitude, disables Grief, it disables weird shit like Sigarda's Aid triggering Colossus Hammer, it disables Stoneforge Mystic. It also has 7 toughness. That's a critical threshold for Unholy Heat. I think, despite all of the weird commentary about, oh, should Elish Norn be legal in Commander, I think, in reality, it's actually a good card for Constructed. Just because it does a lot of weird shit. An Omnath plus 1 land drop plus Elish Norn is you get the life and the mana just from that 1 land. You can double Solitude something, you can double Fury, a bunch of stuff. You can double Leyline Binding, although that's actually one of my least favorite plays, because then if you get Bosager, you get completely obliterated when that happens. So I actually try not to do that very often, unless I know they're not a Bosager deck.
Yeah, notably does not double Fable in any way, shape, or form.
No, so I believe that's like a... It's like a special action to tick up a Saga, then... It's not a trigger or whatever. It just,
Yeah, we're gonna sort of nod along to that, and it does not work. It's not ETB triggers. It's just a separate trigger based on the number of counters. Right. So Elish, really good. 7 greater than 6. I know we promised less math, so that's the extent of it.
Right.
So the other, I guess, piece of this that kind of came with Elish is you'd mentioned Eladamer's Call becoming more stock. That was more of a 80 card Yorian card, and it's sort of circled back around. Is it noticeably worse in the 60 card builds? Because that has not been my experience on the other side of the table. It's like just as good, and I don't know what has it even lost since the 80 card builds?
Well, the last 4 80 card build I played had Traverse Uvenwald, Unholy Heat, and Mishra's Bauble. So in some sense, Call is worse than Traverse for sure, because the buyout on Traverse is that you get a land on turn 1. So I think that is sort of a significant difference. I think you remember the Daryl Ayers slash leading me to win RCQ in that format with Emrakul and Traverses. I do think Eldari's Call is definitely worse than Traverse. I think in terms of the cards you actually want to tutor for, it's basically the same, frankly. Like, I didn't play like a lot of weird shit before, and it's only in the sideboard you see a bunch of like kind of hammers or, you know, more coverage against certain cards, you know?
It's really just Emrakul, right? Like, that's the only losses, right, that you can't afford the Delirium. So yeah, it probably should just be in all of these decks. Also, like, I think in a 60 card deck, the good colors aspect of it matters a little more. Just right. Like, it's harder to crunch everything in. And having another green card for Endurance is really appreciated. So I guess you had listed this alternative to Call, and that is this. You just said Weirdo Respect the Cat list with Eldritch Evolution. Yeah. Do you want to talk a little bit about this stuff?
Yeah, so actually, when I went back to rebuild the four color list, what I do a lot of the time is I don't spend that much time playing when I understand what the constraints of the format are. I just look at what other people think is happening in the format. Respect the Cat, a notorious, well, I guess esteemed four color player. Let's not use the word notorious, I suppose. That person plays a lot of four color and basically only four color. They've tried basically everything. The list that they ended up on, I think, was like five Wall of Omen type of cards, Eldritch Evolution, Omnath, Elishnorn, a lot of weird stuff that I don't think anyone else has done. But I did consider playing this because one of the things I thought about is I do think these four-color decks are way softer to Ragavan than they used to be, specifically if you don't want a two-for-one yourself, is what I mean. Of course, you can always, like, you know, Force of Will it with your Solitude or whatever, but going down two cards is a real cost, whereas casting a Wall of Omens, well, no one wants to use a removal spell on a Wall of Omens, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned the kill spells in this deck were four binding, four ending, and that's not very conducive to beating a Raghavan on one. There's a lot of, like, diciness. Also, like, dashing a Raghavan is pretty problematic here.
Right.
So, yeah, the lack of Bolt is certainly a thing for these lists that Wall of Omens would help with. I don't really buy these Aether Channelers, but I like a lot of the other cards that are going on in this deck.
So the other reason I had an inkling of playing this deck was a friend of the podcast, CCR, aka Chris Cashel-Rappel, actually bought Solitudes to play this deck and very easily won his RCQ. He was usually a Living End one trick, but then he said, oh, playing Solitude is kind of broken. Why didn't I do this before? And then he was like, yeah, this is one of the easiest RCQs I played. I'm just like, yeah, you played most of the good cards.
Yeah, the incarnations are really good. Solitude is a very, very good one. I'm currently partial to Grief and Fury right now, but, like, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's they're all just really good. I guess, you know, we're talking about these tutor toolboxes. Have you considered playing more than 60 or, like, they're...
Yeah, exactly.
No Yorians.
Do you remember when Batu Hina played the 80-card deck in the showcase with two Elishnorns and a bunch of that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, someone finished in the top 32 of a challenge this week with that deck.
Yeah, I played that for a bit. I'm just like, wow, Elishnorn's... Trying that deck actually made me realize how good Elishnorn was, but I also did feel the fact that, okay, why exactly are we playing 80 cards? Is our mana actually better? Are we actually gaining anything significant out of it? And when I thought about it more and more, I came to the conclusion the answer is not particularly... You could sell me on, like, 64, like, Ben Rubin style from that Abzan blue deck from Grand Prix Oakland, but color me a real skeptic. I think you need a really good reason to go above, and, like, not just an arbitrary-sounding reason. It better be well thought out. Don't just do it because you're playing 69 cards and you can say nice.
Okay, that's good. We'll keep that note down there. I guess... You're playing 60 cards with Abundant Growth, though. That card has always felt like a bit of filler. Is it really making its due in the last couple of slots? Is that, like, specifically this is good to top deck with Elishnorn and early thing? Is it, like, an anti-Blood Moon in the metagame thing? Or just kind of, like, I don't know, it's nice to have, and there's two slots that wouldn't be used well otherwise?
I am worried about Blood Moon. I think one of the ways you can lose to Rakdos is definitely... them cheesing you with Blood Moon. I'm sure you know that from the other side pretty well. It's also material you can pick up with Teferi 3, which I think sometimes it's kind of hard to, like, do anything meaningful with Teferi 3 on certain boards. Like, say versus, like, an Azorius control deck, sometimes you play Teferi 3, there's nothing good to bounce, but you also want to get your value out of it because it might get ending next turn or whatever. So you just catching it in on an abundant growth is kind of nice.
Okay, yeah, that's a piece of the puzzle I hadn't quite put together there, that it's just, like, a thing to draw an extra card off of and build it. I guess build a divination. The mana here is pretty free and pretty good. I don't really have a lot of thought on which two triomes. Like, is there a reason it's Jetmirs and Zagoth versus, like, Raugrin and Zagoth or whatever?
So, one thing I think... I was in a bunch of Discord chats with people discussing this with the old version with Expressive Iteration and Fury and Solitude. And if you want to play Leyline Binding, I think you have to play Zagoth if you're going to play Sacred Foundry. But also, there are just a lot of times where you need to get double red, double white access in a longer game because of Hardcast Fury and Solitude. So that means Jetmir's Garden is usually correct. And Zagoth Triumph is good because a natural fetch pattern is turn one, fetch Jetmir, turn two, fetch a tap Zagoth, and lay on binding their thing.
Okay, that checks. I guess what's the difference between Jetmirs and Raugrin in that situation?
I had more endurances before, so just having double green, like, it's basically, you just have to imagine how you want to fetch. Most configurations, if you work out, like, number-wise, it usually works out. But this one, it's just, it made it easier for me to fetch. And I think Hussar, me, Andre Kopach, Alex Rubin, we all sort of agreed that Zagoth plus Jetmir was the best, just after playing a bunch of games.
Okay. Yeah, and I guess with Abundant Growth, you are kind of incentivized to have a green triome in some sense. You can, like, Jetmir into Growth any other land and do whatever there. So... I guess the card that we've sort of not really mentioned is Omnath. Has that card gotten significantly worse without a Yorion to dump the mana into, or does it still just take over the games?
I think if you didn't have Eladamri's Call in your deck, it might be sometimes hard to dump the mana into it, but it sort of works out that way that you do have, like, you might be, like, wasting, like, one mana, but I think Eladamri's Call for a, you know, incarnation and hard casting it, that's plenty good use of 7 mana, you know?
Okay. What do you think about the lists that have Risen Reef in that sort of role? Like, also as a way to fuel your cards in hand, like, just generally good with all your incarnations. Like, I think that they'd probably be taking up the spots that you have Fables or whatever here. Because those have been the lists that have been putting up results in paper.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up. When I played Risen Reef before, I always hated the fact that it was so fragile and was kind of clunky. Whereas Fable, I mean, it's kind of hard to sing the praises of this card enough by this point, but it's so good in the games where things aren't going perfectly for you. If your hand's, like, dysfunctional in some sort of way, Fable, like, you can just churn, right? And also synergy with Ryan 6. And also, there are some decks I think just can't beat Fable plus Incarnation. And I think you know that from Rakdos Scam. But, like, sometimes you just softlock someone with a flipped Fable Fury or flipped Fable Solitude. Don't get me started on what happens when you have Elishnorn, Fable, and one of those. Like, everything's dead, and they're dead.
I actually think it's a little different in Rakdos, just because it's often the times where you control an incarnation are from you triggering it so many times early that it doesn't matter.
Sure.
I had the experience with Fable where I, like, activated it once in 8 or 9 rounds of play. Where it's just, I think it also has to do with the nature of, like, Grief versus Solitude, where, like, you're, I don't know, when you have Grief and Fable, like, yeah, you can lock your opponent's draw step out, but, like, if that's the point of the game, you just win in, like, a million other ways. Whereas, like, Solitude Fable is, I think, a scarier setup and more likely. Also, like, Fury, like, all their stuff is just going to die the first time. You don't need to do it twice. Like, let's be real most of the time. The only thing that's going to survive a Fury is Elish, and then you can't Fury their Elish. It's just not how the rules work.
I think possibly Four Color is better at forcing that sort of situation where they have a bunch of stuff flying around, then you kill it all. instead of Rakdos. Because I think if the point, if the game gets to that point for Rakdos, you're usually dying rather than like the game being close, right?
I don't know. That may have been true of the builds that didn't have a million Pyros and Fables. You can do a lot with that from there. I guess talking about some minor alternatives, would you consider any Bolts over Endings, or I guess Oath of Nissa's over Abundant Growth?
So I thought about Oath of Nissa over Growth. My issue is, I think it doesn't really solve the problem I wanted to solve, which is Blood Moon. I just want to be a little bit more resilient to Blood Moon than a lot of the other lists. That's why I think sometimes you see the lists that have like 63 cards for Abundant Growth popping up as well. And I think that's just a nod to Rakdos being such a huge player in the format, or to Murktide's Blood Moons in a post-board game, you know? Just getting that extra equity, I think, is good. Oath of Nissa, I think, is okay, but doesn't solve as many problems as Abundant Growth does.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's better to bounce, but like, that's about it. Also, maybe it's just more of a factor in the list that have Cavernous Souls, just so you don't actually strand yourself with a Ren and Six in hand. Which, I don't know, Cavern is, some lists have one. I kind of like your decision to play zero, just because I like casting my spell. Like, Leyline Binding in Cavern is not a thing I ever want to have happen to me.
Well, also, I think once you play Risen Reef, you should probably like look to play Cavern, but that's another reason not to play the Reef, I think, just so you can have slightly better mana. I think Cavern is also good if you consider playing it over another spell in this deck, but generally, I think without Risen Reef in your deck, it's kind of unnecessary. That's the cutoff for me, basically.
What about Ephemerate? Do you tie that solely to Reef as well, or do you see value in it in lists like this? Under so, like specific metagames.
It's funny because I actually did write that I cut my third endurance at the last second in the sideboard for Ephemerate. So I think where Ephemerate is good is versus decks that don't have very much removal, which tend to be like hyper linear decks, or decks that if you get to do the thing, it like completely obliterates them. So like versus Amulet Titan, I would want like all Ephemerates I could get. With also the intention of Ephemerate plus Magma Moon is like nearly a hard lock for some. They're going to need to have like two dismembers by that point. And I know they play like three to four nowadays, but just having the ability to like try to play towards an unbeatable game where, you know, sometimes they can play through one Magus, but if you flicker it, they can't win the game.
That's kind of interesting that you cut an Endurance, because that feels like one of the cards that you would most want to pair with Ephemerate. I guess maybe there's some of the, like, the Snapcaster Mage thing going on where, like, oh, Ephemerate is effectively another Endurance against the Graveyard decks, though
right.
I don't think it quite played out that way for you.
Well, unfortunately, like, I think my deck was reasonably well built, except versus my two losses in this tournament, which were Dredge and Gorya's Vengeance. And the thing about those matchups is, if you had, like, seven Endurances in your 75, you would gladly have all of them in your deck. But obviously, you're not allowed to do that. You're allowed to play four, but I didn't even have that four. I had two plus three at Eldarmi's Call, which is not quite the same thing. There was a little bit of the idea that Ephemerate is an effective Endurance, but the problem is with those matchups, Endurance is so time-sensitive that that's not actually true.
Got it. Do you think that the matchup against these linear decks has gotten better or worse without the Yorion and the 20 other cards?
That's an interesting question. I'm not really sure how to answer that question. I think it depends on the linear deck, is what I would have to say. Like, there's a reason I chose these very specific creatures in the sideboard. I guess I'll list them off. One Max of the Moon, one Lavinia, Azorius Renegade, one Orvar. Only one Endurance, not two. The picture has two, but I changed it. A Giant Killer. The Giant Killer is not actually for any combo deck. It's just to kill Elish Norn. That's literally what it's there for. So I think if my opponent's playing like an Urza's Saga like linear deck, the Magus is pretty good. You know, these sideboard dress downs, I guess, which are not tutorable, are pretty good. If my opponent's playing like Cascade, then obviously Lavinia is an all-star. Orvar is not my favorite card, and I think it's actually a little bit overrated by the general public. But I do think having one when you have Old Army's Call or like Goblin Matron or, you know, Flaming Harbingers, you know, something in that vein goes a long way. So I think it does add a bit of utility. But, you know, I would say that unless if it's specifically a linear deck I'm targeting, probably the matchup is worse now than it used to be. But that has nothing to do with Yorion and more than the fact that I think, like, the old list was, like, Traverse plus Counterspell plus, like, maybe some more sideboard Counterspells as well, you know?
Yeah. I guess sort of, like, leaning away from that, let's just talk about this deck's matchup against, you know, the Roggevon decks on the other side of the metagame.
Sure.
Murktide. Murktide had a great weekend this weekend. It has a great weekend every weekend. do you think this list is, like, very well tuned for that, or would you make adjustments if your concern was beating Murktide a lot more?
It's funny you ask that. I'm not sure what it is, but whenever I play against Murktide with almost any deck, I feel like I win more often than I don't. And I'm not sure if it's just because I understand both sides of the matchup better, but I would say in general that I think this list, as long as you don't get Blood Moon, you're probably going to win. In fact, I've played against Murktide, gotten hit by Ragavan twice, and very easily came back to win like five turns later or whatever, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you have some margin there, mm-hmm. but like, would you, like, is Fable good versus them? Is a Pile of Fury good versus them?
Fury's sometimes great, and often I think just a Flame Tongue Kavu is the best way of putting it. Like, you rarely get into a situation where Fury can kill two of their things because they play around that, generally speaking. Like, I think most of the Murktide players that I think are good would never really leave themselves exposed to a Fury unless if it shortens the clock a significant amount, is how to best put it. Fable, I think it's like exactly fine for some. Sometimes it's great. Oftentimes it's there to just dump lands you've picked up with Ren 6. Like, I think one thing that is different for this deck than a lot of the other four color decks is Fable's just Faithless Looting a lot of the time. It's Faithless Looting plus two bodies. It's like your Season Pyromancer, I guess, is a better analogy. Because Ren and Six decks tend to flood because of how the game plays. Like, you draw lands naturally, but you're also picking up lands from your graveyard. You just always end up with, like, five lands in hand, you know?
Yeah, that is a very common play pattern for these decks. And I guess one of the other issues that I sort of alluded to when talking about, like, Omnath running out of things to spend mana on is just, like, you have a lot of lands and things that put lands into your hand. Also, like, between, like, lands and removal, it's very easy to get glutted in a, like, no-threat spot with this deck.
Yeah, that's definitely a problem. Like, the original version had this problem even worse. The original Zoomer version, I think, had, like, one Fury, four Fable, four Iteration. So you did a lot of wheel spinning, is how I would put it. Like, your cards would just draw more cards, but those cards didn't really do anything. Like, you weren't building up to, like, some weird combo endgame like Jeskai Breach does. You just drew more cards, tried to kill off their stuff, and, like, eventually beat them down with maybe a Solitude plus, like, two flipped Fables or whatever, you know? But I think playing this version, hopefully you have enough threat density, because Eld Army's Call is always a threat, and I don't think you really will run out of threats unless if you're playing against someone who's, like, casting Supreme Verdict or something, but I think Azorius control is kind of a joke, personally.
Yeah, I mean, I'll also note that that's a problem with Chalice in this deck, is that it's a card that does not attack mm-hmm. or block, and I'd rather just have cards that can do that and end the game, because this deck has a tendency to not do that. Looping around to the Izzet matchup, are you boarding out Elish there?
No, I leave it in, because it's actually super hard for them to kill. And also, like, if they have something weird, like Furies of their own.
Pyro.
That's what it was. My opponent in the RCQ had Seasoned Pyromancer in their main deck. So once I saw that, I just didn't take it out. I think generally I would not take it out. I think the weaker cards are... I think you could side out Fable in the draw. You could maybe cut a small number of Elodon Rescald, but not all of them. I think you have to leave like one or two. The Veils are pretty good. The Endurances are fine. Vector Green Source is fine. And basically, I'm just trying not to get Blood Mooned. I don't side in Dovin's Veto over some because I don't think that's the type of fight you want to fight. I guess this is not like particularly obvious. I think Flusterstorm is one of the most overrated cards for a four-color deck to play because four-color decks elongate the game. So I think it's actually pretty easy for Cascade decks or Creativity decks to just wait until your Fluster does nothing.
Yeah, Living End especially, right? Like, that's the big one right, where they just, like, have six mana and pay.
Well, the other time was in the other RCQ I played, and I lost to Creativity in, like, a close set, was I drew Flusterstorm. They played Teferi 3. I'm like, I'm never doing this again. Please, just for the love of God, let me have something that let me cashes out versus Teferi 3.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. The Creativity matchup is a great reason to move to Veto, and I was going to ask about that as we kind of broke down the sideboard. Veil, obviously, really good, or I guess still good versus Murktide. I know that people were very high on it. I started pretty low on it against Murktide, but like came around to it doing a thing. Like, do you still really like it there?
I like it there because I think the most common way for you to lose to Murktide outside of Blood Moon is they get a tempo advantage and they just counter all of your spells. Like, I'm not even joking. Like, they have a functional draw, they don't mulligan, they cast an iteration, like stock their hand up, they cast counterspell on your big thing. If you ever have Veil at some point within that mix, I think the pendulum swings back in your favor because you've traded like one for two or three and you get up another card, you know?
That's, yeah. Moving back to the main deck, is Leyline Binding basically just, I mean, it's obviously a concession to the literal card Murktide Regent. Mm-hmm. If that card didn't exist, would you rather have something else or do you still really like Leyline Binding versus the field?
I think I generally like it versus the field. The matchups where I don't like it are when people have Buseiju who endures in their deck in like large quantities. So like, I think a good example of this is I'm way less high on using that as an answer in the four color mirrors than I feel like other people are. And I actually tend to sideboard glow on them to try to like decrease my exposure to of it. Of course, like if you side all of them out, you can like just lose to like a Ren 6. Uncontested or whatever, you know, but I just hate getting Buseiju'd and they get their thing back and I like lose to the thing later. Like an Oblivion Ring is not a safe thing sometimes, but I think you have to play it because there's just it being an instant is so powerful compared to like the other options that it is just like a lot of weird coverage in spots that you would not think that the card's great. Like I think having multiple Leyline Bindings in your hand versus Creativity is really, really strong in game one and a little bit less good in a post-board game. Mostly because like they'll like tend to try to wait you out and try to build up a slightly bigger Creativity. Then if you have two bindings, like you blow them out by getting both of their things, you know. Basically, cast out for one mana is a good card. Sometimes I side down on it because of Naturalizes or Buseiju's because I wanted to decrease my exposure. But back to the Elishnorn point, I think for certain decks, if you have Elishnorn plus binding, the game's over. And versus other decks, if you put two things under a binding, they both say you, the game's over in a complete opposite way.
Yeah. I guess a sort of follow-up question to that is like, are you happy with binding against Scam? Where it's both like an okay removal spell, but also like kind of pretty hampered by Blood Moon, often costing, what, like, three or four and being, like, literal Oblivion Ring?
Yeah, it's not the best for a Scam, but the thing about that matchup is, it's like a Junmir to me, so I have all of the answers in my deck regardless. Like, I'll have, like, basically all the removal spells you see, the Endings, the Bindings, the Furies, and the Solitudes, I don't take any of them out.
Got it. So you just try to kill all their stuff up the curb. And
yeah, well, basically, but it's like a Jun
mirror. Pretty long in that, so...
Yeah. It's a Jun mirror, essentially. Like, the difference is they're a lot better at getting way under you. Like, if you have a hand that's, like, kind of clunky and doesn't have any early interaction, you might actually lose them just because they'll, like, play a Ragavan, then, like, you know, hit you once, then play, like, a Spyro, then double grief you later, and then like it's just hard. I think basically the games that Scam wins versus Forcey go one of two ways. Either like Scam has forced the game to be a low resource game, which I think it's a lot better at doing because Forcey needs like a minimum number of lands to operate, or there's just Blood Moon Cheese, which is, you know, that's why it's called Ractor Scam. Sometimes you just scam and win with something stupid.
I've actually had the experience where I think that the Rakdos deck can also just win a lot of games in the middle where its Fury kills an Omnath, and then like,
sure,
just because you have a stack of Pyros and Fables, you are better at actually converting cards into more cards in the mid game as long as your opponent runs out at some point.
It's kind of hard for this deck to run out. Like, there's not a lot of pure card drawers, but there's just, like, enough, like, things, right? The Furies are pretty good. Oh, I think versus Rakdos, one thing I do want to mention is I don't think Elestron is particularly good versus them. If you know that they don't have, like, 3+ Terminate, then you could consider leaving it in. Otherwise, I think it's, like, honestly not very good most of the time.
Yeah, I was leaving in some number of Terminates, and it was kind of arbitrary, but, like, Terminate killing Omnath is also just really important, so it's not like it's going to be bad. Like, oh no, I killed a Fury. Like, yeah, it's going to be good against them. And, like, the good colors part when a lot of it is just, like, having the ability to line up your Scam effects early, too, just really powerful.
Oh, one thing I did versus Scam was, instead of waiting for my Reflection to lose some sickness, I just used Teferi to bounce my Fable and replay it immediately. Because I didn't think it was ever going to live to a relevant board state to, like, actually start copying things. And I just wanted to cash in, like, another Faithless Looting, you know?
Yeah, another 2-2, another looting. Pretty darn good. Also, like, a card off the Teferi is something that you can loot. You're leaving in max Teferis against Scam, right? Just to, like, stop their actual Scam pieces.
Well, for the puzzle. Yeah, but that's, like, a mid-game Scam. I don't think I actually lose to a lot mid-game Scams. It's usually, the turn one double grief. Or the Magus. Or I guess if you've Thoughtseized me twice and then see it's safe, then I could probably get like double grief on a later turn, and that's where the Teferi might shine, right?
Well, there's also just like, if you Fury their thing and they just have the Feign Death.
Right. Yeah, you're actually right. I've actually played a lot of games where they just like play like a weird sort of protect their big creature game, and it's kind of annoying. You know, or small creature. Ragman's not that big, I suppose.
Yeah, the whole ability to like eat a minus with a Feign Death and then Ragavan kills the Ren and Six or whatever, that's pretty good. Hey, Teferi, like, that card's pretty good against the broad meta right now, right? Like, there's a bit more cascade than there's ever been. Decks are like not the best at attacking it down.
I think it's just kind of the case that if you told me a format, like, you would have to have a very warped format for Teferi to be bad, I think, is the actual reality. I think in most formats, it would actually be reasonable, if not great. And, you know, sometimes it's, like, insane. But, like, just like a generic constructed format, I struggle to think of a generic constructed format where Teferi would not be a good card.
I've found it to be bad. Like, when Hammer and Yawgmoth are doing very well, the card is not great.
Yeah, but it's still, like, not even the worst. It's just, like, kind of game-dependent, right? There are certain games versus Yawgmoth where I think having Teferi in play makes it so much easier because, you know, they can't, like, Court of Calling for their missing piece or whatever, you know?
I mean, that involves... It's good if you're already ahead enough that you can't be attacked.
Right.
I think it's the big deal. Yeah, I guess I think that those are just, like, less likely now than they've been for a decent amount, especially with, like, you know, creativity. Just Teferi's really good versus that deck.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of funny because I think it's A, good in that deck and good versus that deck, which is kind of a weird place for it to be. I've definitely, like, had games where both of us had Teferi, but actually favors them, I think. Generally speaking, because what'll happen is they'll just like double arc on you and kill all your stuff.
Yeah, that was one of the big upgrades of the Archon kill, was that the double Teferi games used to be really bad for creativity because they would just have an Emrakul in their hand, and now they're just really good for creativity because the other player doesn't have a hand or permanence.
It turns out Cruel Ultimatum for like 5 mana is a really good, really, really good card.
Yeah. You are not veiling against creativity, right?
I do, because one of the things that actually happens is they try to fight over your Teferis and stuff. And also, I think the way this deck is constructed, you could actually veil the Archon triggers and untap just like Elishnor and Solitude, both of the Archons.
Okay, that's fair. Before Elish, I didn't really love it, but like...
Oh yeah, sure. I think if you tried to do that before, what would end up happening is you would end up like killing one of their Archons, and then you'd be like, okay, what do I do about this other Archon? And then just like lose the game to that 1/6/6. Whereas now I think like there's a realistic proposition that you veil the triggers or whatever, you know, it doesn't hit you, you untap, have enough stuff to be able to do the play I described. And if you don't, maybe you have like, you know, a Teferi bounce plus a Solitude as well, which is not ideal, because remember how I said, like, I thought the games drag out versus 4C? They often drag out to the point where they can hard cast their Archons too. So you're going to have to deal with it at some point.
Yeah, that's totally fair. And yeah, you're going to have to do that. And I guess Veil is pretty good versus a hard cast Archon for setting that up too. I guess what would be, you know, we talked about the Ephemerate. What would like the 17th and 18th sideboard slots be, for example, in a metagame where you didn't need this Force of Vigor?
Fourth Jovan's Veto is the one that I like cut at the last second. That's like really close to me. I might actually end up going back to playing an extra Endurance or two. Just because I do think people like to play like the goofy, like Spiraling Spike Goryeo's deck or whatever, like Dredge, like literal. I actually looked at that person's list and I went to Sodex like last result, and the lists were pretty similar, except my opponent had Conflag and Sodex didn't. So I don't know what actually happened there. Maybe they're just like playing with Conflagrate. So kind of interesting to think about, you know?
Yeah. I don't really understand a lot of the like one-off choices in Dredge these days, because right. The big picture of like, here are some Dredge cards and the Cathartic Reunions and the Oxes is so much bigger and so much more important. The deck is just so much better at just like, my entire deck is in the graveyard, here's 20 power, good luck. And like the minor stuff where you're just like, I don't know, I made 5 power on this turn, attacked twice, and then dealt the last 7 with a life and alone. That doesn't happen.
No, it doesn't happen. I think if you also try to play that type of game nowadays, you could lose to Omnath. So
yes, that's very true.
Like, I've actually had a non-zero number of games like versus these versions of Dredge where I just played an Omnath on 4, it didn't get killed, I just stabilized the game and eventually beat them like 6 turns later. It's always like kind of close. They're always like really, really close to killing you when you have Omnath out, but it's never enough because you're gaining like 8 life per turn cycle.
Yeah, the sack on mine, sack on yours is really huge there. Anything else you want to talk about on the list, or should we wrap up with just like a thumbs up, thumbs down, quick hits on the big matchups of the format?
The thing I might actually do, and this might sound kind of bizarre, like I was singing the praises of Eldamri's Call, but I think there's like a limit to how many you actually want to play. One of those might actually become an Ephemerate for me as well in the main deck, just as, like, as a nod to, like, you know, upping your percentage versus Yawgmoth, upping your percentage versus Ambiotitan, and it just like does enough in some spots. You like keep them honest, and also like the Omnath into Norn into Solitude Ephemerate, like it's just a little bit, it's kind of absurd how much stuff that is. Right.
Yeah, and Fable is yet another thing that's good with Ephemerate on both sides of like, Ephemerate is sometimes a dead card that goes to your graveyard and turns into a new card, but also just like Ephemerating a Fable is a totally fine play.
How many times did you Feign Death Fable when you were playing Scam?
Once or twice.
I have to imagine that's pretty good as well.
Yeah, I think that there's a bit of a problem there where like a lot of the games where you would think that is good, the Feign Death has already gone to your graveyard from the two, where you're just like, I just need cardboard. I don't really care. Like, I'll just find new cardboard. Sure. It usually happens when you have discarded your Feign Death and then drawn another Feign Death.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess let's quickly, we talked about, is it generally think that matchup's favorable, but close?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of room. Like, I think in modern nowadays, when you play these like good card decks versus good card decks, like as so much of Murktide is a good card deck, there's actually like a fair amount of room to maneuver on both sides. So I hesitate to like say like it's a great matchup or like give a number, but I generally think with the Teferis, with the Solitudes, with the Leyline Bindings, that it's a reasonably good matchup, but of course you can lose it, you know?
Yeah, okay. Creativity?
Game one, not great, but you can also win. Post-board, with all my Dovin's vetoes, I feel a lot better with the matchup. I also side in the Dress Downs, the Boseiju. I'm unsure if I'm supposed to Magus versus them still, and I haven't been able to figure this out. My instinct is no, but I don't really have a good reason one way or the other. Like, it's just, I've been trying to figure it out.
Is Boseiju just to cover Fable so it's less of a problem, or?
Also, when I'm siding in, like, the extra Veils, I want another green source. Okay. Also, like, killing their binding with that has, like, an Omnath under it or something like that also matters a lot.
Oh, yeah, if they're the five-color list.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. Like, this is what I was talking about with binding versus, like, other Boseiju decks. It's kind of scary, but this, like, the reverse applies versus, like, opposing decks with Leon binding. Then I definitely want my third Boseiju, basically, versus all of them.
That's fair. Rakdos, we talked about a decent amount. Close but favored, similar to Murktide. Mm. Just people grinding each other out, and you are probably a little ahead in that fight.
Mm-hmm.
Hammer?
I would say I'm probably favored, but I think it's just like kind of draw dependent. Like, this was always
dependent too. You have the extra Boseijus and Force.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because I think, like, I know Will Kruger said he thought this matchup was, like, slightly unfavorable instead of, and a lot of people are just like, this matchup is just bad. I don't know who to believe. I suspect the truth is just that, like, it's a skill differential thing again. Like, I'm going to say that a lot, but I just think there's, like, mulligan decisions with Hammer that are complicated. People just keep hands they're not supposed to. It's also just, like, how many Lavinias are you playing or something like Hushbringer? That matters too. It's just a lot of weird shit that, you know, adds up to a fair amount. And I think Will has just played like more matches of Hammer than like most people on, you know, the bird site.
That's, yeah. I mean, you said this like, oh, it all depends. Like, you said it about Murktide and Hammer, which are the two hardest decks to play in the format. So, yeah, mm-hmm. That's totally reasonable. The Cascade decks, still good?
I like the Rhinos matchup. I think Living End is slightly unfavorable, if I had to guess, because, I mean, just, I don't know how to put it exactly, but it feels like the, versus Rhinos, the games are pretty straightforward. Versus Living End, the games are not really straightforward, is the best way of putting it.
Do your extra Furies help a lot there? Just like a thing you can put in the graveyard?
Yeah, they do. Fable also kind of important if they don't like literally turn through you. Like when I played against Living End with Fable in my deck, if I landed a Fable and I got to the next chapter, I just discarded two elementals. Like just every time.
Your sideboard's pretty well set up, right? Like
sure,
Lavinia,
yeah.
Magus, triple Dovin's Veto, extra Endurances and Veils are all cards I would want in the matchup.
Yeah, I think game one is like slightly unfavorable, and I think post-board I'm like a pretty heavy favorite if I had to guess.
It's just scary because, I mean, this is the classic Living End issue where like,
sure,
they will be on the play once post-board in most matches, and that is a problem.
Yeah, and like sometimes Lavinia is not fast enough because like you can cast on turn three, but you don't even get a turn three. But this is the reason I actually like Dovin's Veto, because I mean like they have no recourse versus a veto. Like, it's just done, you know?
Yeah. Just going to resolve, and their Living End is not. Burn matchup is still just, like, I don't know, resolve an Omnath or something. There's not a lot of nuance there.
The one thing, I noticed which category you skipped. The mirrors, I think, are just very list dependent, but I think there's also a ton of play. One thing to note is if you play land binding, you can actually prismatic ending a Elish Norn if you have the Zagoth Triumph in your deck. If you don't play Leyline Binding, you can't. So it's actually like kind of a big differential because the games go on forever. Like your mana is generally not an issue in those mirrors. Like no one gets killed. You have time to like draw out of like weird mana issues. So generally what happens in these mirrors is I think it's like it goes a few ways. If someone just like has like all of the planeswalkers and they go uncontested, they're like a heavy favorite. The other thing is like you play a planeswalker, it gets killed. They play a planeswalker, it gets killed. So you're like both at parity. Then someone goes like Omnath into like elemental on the same turn, then they're ahead. But then like the other person goes like Omnath into Elish Norn, and then like everything's shut down. But one thing that can also happen is just both people have Elish Norn out, then it's like actually kind of miserable. Because like none of the cards do anything except Teferi 3 bounces it from one turn. Ending for 5 works, but yeah, not a lot of your other cards do very much.
Are you ever Boseijuing their Black Source to protect your Elish?
That did not come up. I think that's like not where you want to be unless if the game has gone really, 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 really long.
Okay. The Yawgmoth matchup we've hashed out a few times. Like Yurlitz has a million Furies. That's really good versus them. Yurlitz doesn't have Ephemerate. That's not great versus them. But like overall, the matchup is really on them to try and win as opposed to the four color deck to try and lose.
Yeah, but I think I might end up like remember this. The actual picture is not quite correct. I actually think I'll probably
main deck Ephemerate, right? Like supporting in. I'm just like, sure. The lists that were the scariest as Yogg were the ones that were the heaviest on main deck Ephemerates.
Yeah, I think I'm going to end up with 1+1 just because I think it's like good versus weird linears as well.
Amulet Titan. How does that matchup go?
Well, if I thought there was a lot more Amulet, I would move this Magus of the Moon. Like, I'm not even joking. It would end up in my main deck. I think probably game one is just kind of draw dependent, honestly. I also think the post-war games are also kind of draw dependent, but in a different way. Game one, I think if they're in the play, you're probably just going to lose most of the time because most of what you do doesn't matter, and you don't do it fast enough for it to actually matter very much, if I had to guess.
Yeah, it seems like game one, a lot of your plan is just like, don't die, cast Elish, and then from there stabilize with a kill spell up, and like you're just never getting to that point.
Yeah, that's hard. Like, it was easier when you had a bunch of counter spells, but even sometimes that failed because of cavernous holes. It's just hard, I think. And in the post-board games, the most important thing is to protect your Magus of the Moon from their removal if possible. And that involves, like, maybe waiting in turn sometimes for Ephemerate backup, you know?
That's fair. Yeah, you don't just want to lose to their random dismember that they might draw.
Yeah, and also most competent Amulet Titan players know that a deck like this usually has Magus of the Moon in the sideboard. So it's not like you're like really going to catch them off guard, you know?
Yeah. And I think the last deck before we delve into the real garbage tier stuff that like, I don't even want to ask you how your Mill and Tron matchups are because I know they're bad. That's fine. That's part of the thing about playing four color.
Well, I will say something about those matchups where I think I generally beat Mill in paper and lose to the MTGO Mill players. There's like this weird and I don't really have an explanation except I think most of the paper players who are good don't play Mill IRL, whereas the MTGO Mill players tend to be a bit better, is how I would put it.
Yeah. Yes. I don't want to account for your opponent just like losing the game to their own inability to play their cards here. Like, I think if your Mill opponent just like takes reasonable game actions, it's going to be tough. But what about the Jeskai Breach matchup? Because that's a deck that like, I guess should be winning more than it is. And I don't quite know why it isn't, but like, it feels like it's sort of built with four color in mind of just like applying pressure on a lot of different angles.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up because the RCQ I won in the first season was I was playing 4C versus Jeskai Breach in the finals, and I just ran them over in 2 games. I think a lot of that matchup is understanding when you can take risks and when you can't, really. And what I mean by that is, like, playing into their stuff, holding up removal, holding up leyline binding for their breach. There are times where, like, you should probably leave it up, and there are times where you should just tap out and be like, all right, whatever, I don't care about your thing this turn.
Okay.
Like, I think it's just, like, 1,000 judgment calls. And specifically in that Season 1 RCQ, I'll just recap what happened real quick. I just sat there taking Ragavan hits until I could deploy something with Counterspell backup, then my opponent lost the game. Like, I literally, like, I think I got hit by Ragavan 3 times or something like that. I don't remember, but basically, I disrespected their ability to fair me so much that I'm just like, I don't care. You can, like, hit me 3 times. It probably won't matter. And it didn't. So, scoreboard, I guess, back then.
That's fairly aggressive to say that they just won't be able to cast a Teferi off the top of your deck or whatever.
Yeah, then I would have to burn my counterspell.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah, that makes sense that if you condense the ways that they're going to win, like, there is a game plan that you can't realistically beat if you let them resolve it, so you should just play to not let them resolve it, because mm-hmm. the other game plans, there are ways around. That makes a lot of sense of how to approach that matchup. So, anything else you want to talk about in a four color, or are you ready to move on to talking about this week's modern results?
Well, I think Dress Down's still a pretty good card. We didn't really cover that one, but
yeah.
I did kill Territorial Kavu in my testing games at some point with that card, which was another reason I never wanted to touch Domain Zoo again. I mean, you and I have had not great results with that deck, or really even comprehend why it's a good deck, is what I would say.
There are so many reasons that deck is bad versus four color, and Dress Down is like the 17th. It's just not a tenable matchup in any sense.
But yeah, I think that's all I got for it. Oh, if you want to win a 4C mirror, like for real, and your deck sort of looks like this, Emrakul of the Promised Sand is still probably the way to go. Like, not joking. Even though, like, it's still going to cost, like, a ton of mana, but, like, realistically, no one attacks your graveyard, so you'll probably have, like, a random sorcery, a random instant, a random creature, and a land in the graveyard. And by that point, 9 is not that much in these 4C mirrors. That's all I'm going to say. Yeah.
The difference between, like, 7 and 9 is, like, whatever. Like, it's just going to happen at some point, and you'll get there. Okay. So, I guess, turning to the modern results, not a lot of really exciting new stuff going on this week. A lot of a lot of creativity popping back up, especially in the paper events. A decent amount of Rakdos. Amulet popular in paper, not so much online. I think the big notable result is that the Ephemerate Goryeo's Vengeance deck took down a challenge. And then the other decks that I want to talk about that made the top 8 of a challenge is like 20... like, was it right before Modern Horizons 2 came out, there was the Esper control deck that mm-hmm. had... it was just blue-white with Kaya's Guile.
Yep.
And basically that deck made the top 8 of the Modern Super Qualifier this weekend. It's just... it's just Esper with Drown in the Lock main and Kaya's Guile sideboard. And there's a Murderous Rider, but I think... oh, Kaya Orzhov Usurper, another classic of that era. That's just not a lot of black spells and 4 Timeless Dragon.
You know what? I did look at this list and I thought a few things were weird. The first thing that popped out to me was there are 3 Counterspell, 3 Drown the Lock instead of 4 Counterspell, 2 Drown the Lock. It's a 61 card deck and there's a main deck Temporary Lockdown, which I think is smarter than a lot of the other choices made in this deck.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that the Drown versus Counterspell split is kind of a concession to, like,
yeah,
legally allowed. I guess there's Thoughtseize, too. I missed that. I was not counting Dan either, just because, like, it's, I don't know, it's Wrath of God. But, like, Drown as a flexible removal spell, there is a reasonable contingent of, like, Cavern of Souls decks that you aren't legally allowed to have Counterspell in your deck against. Sure. And there's some amount of hedging there. And also, right. I think that just versus, like, is it Murktide? The card Counterspell out of the control decks is pretty bad, but being mm-hmm. able to be, like, reactive with a Drown on a Raghavan or whatever at, like, a specific time when, sure. like, you may have been caught tapped out, I think that's pretty important.
I do think Timeless Dragon's lifting a lot of heavy weight in this deck, because otherwise I think the land count is pretty irresponsible.
22 with a Reflecting Pool and a Sunken Runes? And a Sunken Runes is kind of a lot.
Well, how else are you going to cast your Drown the Locks, Dams, and Counterspells?
Great question. If I were to play this deck, I think that there's probably room to trim down on one of these, like, Shark Typhoons or Planeswalkers. Like, sure. Shark Typhoon, I don't know. I am not the biggest fan of that card in Modern right now, in large part because there just aren't a lot of these control mirrors where it's really good in.
It's funny that you bring that up, because I think the team that brought Is It Great to Be to the Pro Tour were also like, yeah, Shark Typhoon's not really good except in Boom Mirrors. So, like, yeah. if that's the thought in Pioneer, like, shouldn't that be, like, extra the thought in Modern? Question mark?
Yes, I agree 100%. And that's also in a situation where, like, it is a functional combo piece and not just, like,
value.
A card that makes a shark. The other, I guess, sort of headline of this weekend is that Cascade had some reasonable results, and it's still split between Living End and Rhinos, but it feels like that deck is a bit on the upswing right now. Mm-hmm. Despite four color being there to kind of have Teferis, it's just kind of doing better against everything else as Chalice counts and Flusterstorm counts drop.
Yeah, I don't really have a good explanation, except, like, I think structurally Living End is still ahead versus 4C, especially in game one. And also, this person chose to play Subtlety in the SCG, which is also probably a nod to Teferi 3 as well.
It's also pretty good versus Scam, right? Like,
sure, yeah.
You're going to lose to, like, the Rhinos deck, let's say, or whatever. Like, that's where I'm thinking about it. But, like, Living End as well, where, like, you could just get scammed out of the game very quick, and their fastest draws are the ones that can race you. And if you have Subtlety, they don't get to do any of that. I think it's a good time to be playing Subtlety in that deck. Also, like, what are the primary, like, combo decks that are trying to race you? It's like Amulet, Hammer, Yawgmoth. Like, yeah, that you will beat all of those with that card.
Yep, you heard it here first, folks. Play Subtlety in all your decks.
I mean, we started with this, right? The incarnations are just sure. Good.
Right.
Okay. So I guess with that, we can stop talking about real decks and normal decks and start talking about Nonsense of the Week, which, sadly, we don't just get to continue our trend of listing a random deck that won a challenge. But friend of the podcast, Xenowon, had a real nice one for us in the Discord.
Oh, God.
Oh, you've seen this, Jarvis. You know where it's going.
Well, okay. Do you want me to tell you the truth? I did not know what was going to happen until I clicked on this link.
Oh, you didn't?
No! Well, this is a
wonderful Urza Saga deck. The lands are 4 Blackleaf Cliffs, 4 Blightstep Pathway, 4 Urza Saga, 4 Gemstone Mine, and then some wonderful assortment of legendary lands, including Ashinka, the Bloodsoaked Keep. The thing that should clue you into something weird happening is the distinct lack of fetches and blood crypts. Not allowed in this deck. We have the 20 cards in the zero drop column with Lotus Bloom, Profane Tutor, Asmo, Memnite, 2 Mox Amber, and 2 Ornithopter. 13 one drops. So this is where I'm asking you to put on your math hat. It's nonsense time. We can talk about math. There's 13 one drops. Okay. Keep this number 13. Yes. So 4 Infernal Flunge, 4 Ragavan, a Springleaf Drum, and 4 Underworld Cookbook. There's 5 2-drops, 4 Diabolic Intents, and a Grape Shot. So that is 23 total mana cost in this deck that has 1 Ad Nauseam and 4 ways to tutor for it in Diabolic Intent, and another 4 in Profane Tutor. And if you just cast this, you can put your deck into your hand, pretty much. And yeah, then Infernal Plunge for lethal.
So I think you have to remove 2 2s or 2 ones and a 2, and you're safe.
Well, and what if you sacrifice food to cookbook?
Like, you can go
over 20.
Yeah.
And the card that did not make this exact list, but that was brought up by Dom, was Postmortem Lunge, which allows you to start from Ad Nauseam and then go Postmortem a Asmo from my graveyard and then Mox Amber, and that is a way that you can actually end up comboing off no extra mana.
I see.
Yeah.
And you have to get to 20 Storm. What's the time?
Well, you have a lot of cards that cause 0.
Yeah. It does seem difficult to cast a lot of spells in one turn with this deck.
You get 12 off the bat, right? Like, yeah. All the zeros and all the plunges, sure. And the Abnaws is another one, right?
And maybe so, make that shock. 15? Yeah, sure. Yeah.
I think dealing, like, the full 20 might be difficult, but it's probably pretty easy to deal, like, 15-ish.
This really reminds me of the different format, but Hoogwin used to play Land Nauseam in Legacy. So just imagine Ad Nauseam in a lands deck, and just, like, with a random Grape Shot in it. It was just like, it was kind of weird to look at, but it technically worked, I think. Oh, there might have been a Seismic Assault in that deck too, with the Mox Diamonds. That's right.
That would make some sense. I mean, that was the original use of, maybe not original, but one of the early uses was the like 38 land Adnaz Swans deck.
Yeah, it had like one Adnaz main, one sideboard. I think Paulo played that to a pretty good finish. But the person like who invented it was like some, it was either a European or a Brazilian, or maybe it was a Chicago person, or maybe it was just Chicago. Like, okay, it, yeah, I remember looking at that deck is so funny because it's like an inverted Magic deck, right? Like you just flip the numbers around.
Yeah, this deck just gets to cheat and play zeros instead of lands that are zeros. Sure. The sideboard here is kind of a work of art. I like, there's like Pact of Negation and then like Duress Shattering Spree. But the thing that's my favorite is that Engineered Explosives is a zero, and it's also, like, your best out to a lot of permanents.
Yeah, I think, like, Pact of Negation's kind of... It's probably playable, but not great, is how I would put it.
Why would you say that?
Well, so, I think, like, one of the things I would probably want to pack the most in this deck, which you can't, is Teferi Time Raveler. Because it just, like, owns your Profane Tutor. Like, you and Dom have been on this rant so many times that, like, Profane Tutor's enemy is getting Teferi 3'd because that's just such a common play pattern. So, I don't know.
Well, the first pact is really valuable, right? Because you can always tutor for that.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that you're, like, once you are in for the first four Profane Tutors, not even counting the Lotus Blooms, like... You're not gonna like Teferi is like that. You're writing that off. Like whatever, you'll just beat them with Urza Saga or Ragavan. Like that's what this deck has to do there.
Yeah, that's fair. God, yeah. I'm just trying to figure out a way to like Yogg-Will back all of our zeros, but I can't come up with anything.
The one Underworld Breach is maybe on the table, but very unlikely.
I thought of like I'm looking at this. The problem I have with that is I think it's like. It's also, like, another two off of your Adnaz, which is not great.
It would just be another Grape Shot. Like, why would you cast all your spells again? Why wouldn't you just cast a second Grape Shot?
Yeah, maybe that's just the answer. Maybe just putting two Grape Shots in the deck is good.
Yeah, potentially. I'm just glad that this is an Ad Nauseam deck with the appropriate number of Angel's Graces, and this is honestly the best of Ad Nauseams for an Ad Nauseam deck, right? Just one, like you're minimizing all the actual Ad Nauseam stuff and just playing exactly one. Like, when was a deck, that's a lie. I've played two Ad Nauseams and it's been good, but that's like a very conditional thing. Just for future reference, if you're building an Ad Nauseam deck, try to build the one Ad Nauseam deck and not the four Ad Nauseam.
Yeah. Wait, let me guess. The two Adnaz deck, was Mystical Tutor in your deck?
No, I think there may have been. I did not play a lot of that. It was specifically, there were periods of times with Epic Storm where being fast was more important than anything else. So you would just either have two in your main deck or sideboard in the second. And I think that brings us to the end of Nonsense of the Week.
Sure. This
deck was very dense on it.
Yes.
Jarvis, do you want to let the good listeners know where they can find you?
Twitter, great place to reach me. I usually answer most questions, JKY06. I also have like a pinned link to where a lot of my other stuff is, but I'm also on Twitch at JarvisU. And I guess I'm technically on Medify. That's still going to stay up. Sadly, I think I do have a Patreon, but I think I'm going to close that down because... the demands of Patreon are like, you feel obligated to produce something once per month. And I've been really bad about that. So I think I have a lands guide there, which I'm actually planning to update with the bannings, but I'm probably just going to move that to Twitter and, you know, try to work that out and see if people want to buy the guide.
Well, you heard that from Jarvis, but you can find this podcast on Patreon, and we will continue producing content every week for you, which is, I guess, the podcast. You can find the pod, as I said, on Twitter at Dominaria_pod. I'm at ARMLX. Dom is at Dom and Harvia. I'm writing for Channel Fireball these days, and Dom is writing for Star City Games. And yeah, I think that about does it. And Dom and I will be back to discuss Standard, his recent regional championship experience. Standard right now, I don't know if you have any quick thoughts on the format, but I have been relatively impressed with it. It is, I think, I'm not going to go as far as Autumn said, which was, it's the, let's see, Autumn said that it was the best Standard format since, let's see, probably like 2018 or so. I think there's been one or two that have been better, even if you discount the, like, deep-seated love I have for playing Wilderness Reclamation Mirrors. There have been better formats than this since then, but it's certainly up there, and like if you ranked it all time, it would be on the, like, I don't know. If you did an all-time ranking, I would say it's probably like at least, you know, in the 7 out of 10 range, which is pretty darn good.
I have a few quick thoughts. I actually have been playing a fair amount. I'm testing with some people for the regional championship in San Diego. Weirdly, the US one was just supposed to be at the beginning, then it got pushed to the end, and you and I, we've been around the block enough. Generally, what's better to do in these sorts of situations are to see what happens in the first few tournaments, then test a bunch. But I played a little bit with most of the decks just to get a feel for them. Grixis deck, obviously really good, heavily played. Celestia Toxic, also pretty good, because it's mostly good versus Grixis. In terms of how fun the format is or isn't, well, if you like three-color mid-range, this is probably a pretty good format. If you like two-color, like, sort of weird, infecty aggro, also probably pretty good. If you're a fan of monocolor aggro, sorry to say, I don't really think those decks are that good.
Well, next week, you can catch me and Dom here sharing our opinions on these matters. But I'm, you know, again, thanks for showing up, Jarvis. Thanks for talking about four-color with us, because, again, this is a deck that I certainly would play, but not want to make myself an expert on. I don't know. I just haven't felt it recently, but I'm glad that you stopped by and could give us the four color pitch so that us and the listeners are ready to, you know, pick up the deck and jam whenever that is the appropriate thing to do for the metagame.
Yep. Glad to be here. And if you ever get sick and Dom needs a replacement, well, he knows where to find me.
Absolutely. Take care, everybody.